Matt Eisenfeld. Yoni Jessner. Alex Singer. Natha Applebaum. David Applebaum. Sadly, nobody lives for any amount of time in Israel without beginning a list. This is a list of people who have been killed, murdered, attacked. Matt Eisenfeld was a student of... Do you remember Matt?
Yes, sir.
Came to Yeshivat HaMiftar while he was in Yale. He got on the... Came back to study in Israel after he graduated Yale. And he got on with the 18 bus, somewhere along the 18 bus line, with Sarah Duker. He didn't make it to the Tachanun Merkazit, nor did she. Yoni Jessner, whom I barely met only once, remember in Torah Shraga. But as he was being buried, Erev Sukkos, on Har Mruchot, somehow Yoni came to me and gave me a poem. Alex Singer. Alex Singer was a Saul's brother, was a graduate of Cornell, who came to Israel after graduation and volunteered. Became an officer in the army. And a short time before his stint in the army was done, he came to speak to me about coming to the yeshiva. And I sat downstairs with him in what I politely refer to as my storeroom. Others refer to it as the dungeon. And I spoke with him for about an hour and a half, full of promise, full of talent, full of vision, full of giving, in an ambush in which the officer was killed. The next officer in charge crawled to try to save him, and he too was killed. And then Alex tried to save them both, and Alex too was killed. Chafei Elul. Nava Applebaum was a cousin of mine who was to be married on the 13th of Elul in the year 63. And the night before her marriage, after the seating arrangements had been completed, she went with her father to Cafe Hillel for a discussion to get some coffee. And was killed. Her father, David, was missing because David was an emergency doctor in the head of the emergency room at Shaarei Tzedek. And for some reason he didn't show up to treat those in the Cafe Hillel bombing. And seven people, including Nava and David, became members of the this terrible, terrible list. I want to talk mostly about the one whom I knew the best. I knew David as a little boy, a really cute, sweet little kid. In the family, I was known as Big Day. He was Little Day. And then I knew him again when I came to learn in Israel, in Merkez Zarav. His family had just come in Aliyah. As it turned out, it was only for a year. I knew him as a 12-year-old boy. I was at his bar mitzvah. Remarkable. You know, I thought he just wanted to tick his parents off. But, you know, ticking his parent, my uncle, who I'll get to in a moment, was a modern Orthodox rabbi and very modern Orthodox people. So I thought David had a streak of rebellion in him. He grew peyos. He was in a mamlachti school called Dugma, and probably the only kid there with peyot. He began to study safrut. Very determined kid. And when his parents told him that he was going to, returning to America, he was figuring out, and David could have pulled it off at the age of 13. He was figuring out how he wouldn't go back with them. But as he told the story, his father told him, showed him a newspaper article, that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, that's the Rav's brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was becoming the Rosh Yeshiva in a yeshiva in Chicago, popularly called Skokie. And that he, David, would get to go to this yeshiva and study with Rav Aaron. Now, David was... David was busy all the time, and he had time for everything. But all you had to do is mention, even to him as a 13-year-old, anything that had one of two words in them, either the word Soloveitchik or the word Brisk, and he lit up. We were distantly related to the family, and David was very proud of that. And so David did go back to Chicago, and in Chicago he had another role model. David's first role model. I mean, when you hear about David, I'll tell you a little bit about him further. But his first role model was his father, my Uncle Manuel. When my uncle God was kind of compassionate with my uncle, if you had a child like David, he was your whole life. And God took Manny. He died before the tragedy that took place. Manny was just, I told David, as on the way to his father's funeral, I quoted to him Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein said about, in a hesped for Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, guys, you got to get all these names right. Right? If I ask somebody to give me the starting lineup of the Cleveland Cavaliers, right? Probably a lot of people could do pretty well. You know? When I was a kid, I could do that also. I mean, there were no Cleveland Cavaliers, but there were the Brooklyn Dodgers. Right? But they're really, you're growing up, right? It's really more important to know the names that I'm talking about now. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein gave a hesped from Shlomo Zalman Orbach, and he said the following thing. He quoted Rav Chatzkel Abramsky. Gotta get all these names down. He quoted Rav Chatzkel Abramsky. Who said that when Reb Isser Zalman Meltzer died, that's the last name, he gave a hesped. Reb Isser Zalman Meltzer was one of the great Gedolim. And he said about him, had Reb Isser Zalman been an Am Haaretz, you all know what an Am Haaretz is, just about the worst thing in the world. Had Reb Isser Zalman Meltzer been an Am Haaretz, but I mean a real Am Haaretz, I mean even the biggest Am Haaretz in Yerushalayim, he still would have been the nicest person in Yerushalayim. And I said that to David. I said it about his father, because he was the nicest person in Yerushalayim. And that's what David said it over his father's grave, soon to be very near his grave. That was the one role model. The second role model was a person whom it's very difficult to describe his, it's a big word, indefatigability. Did I say it right? Indefatigability. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. Reb Aaron was always learning, always doing. He knew no rest. I was in Reb Aaron Shear in 1962-63 when Reb Aaron was in YU. Always. Very, very unassuming. Very, very modest. And very, very stubborn about that which was right. He wouldn't compromise for anything if compromise was unwarranted. I know the term tzaddik is used easily. David himself once described that Rav Aaron, like 18 years I think before he died, he began suffering from Parkinson's and had to be in a wheelchair and could occasionally barely walk. I saw it, my wife saw it. When he would climb steps, and he insisted on climbing certain steps by himself, he would climb in the following manner. He would say, Achas. And the next step he would say, Achas, Ve'achas, Achas Ushtayim. He would recite what the Kohen Gadol, what was said, this is Avodas HaKodesh. Going places, going to a shir, going to Nichum Aveilim. He would do it himself. Stubbornness, nobody could help him. Godless greatness, because everything he was doing was in the service of God. That's something I heard from David. And David became a passionate devotee, a chassid of Reb Aaron. And Reb Aaron came to rely on David for more and more and more until, of course, he would rely on him for his very health. He would rely on him to publish his sfarim. He would rely on David. Before he came to Eretz Yisrael, and this is with his Parkinson's, he'd call up David and he'd say, David, right, I want you to arrange a meeting for me with the Rosh Memshalah, with this person, just you do it, right? And of course, there were two people who didn't take no for an answer that I knew. One was Rav Aaron, and the other one was David Applebaum. So everything was arranged. David described David had these models. Both of whom were passionate Zionists. As I said, David was always busy, and he had time for everyone and everything. Let me give you a very quick sketch of his education. David learned in Skokie, and I think somewhere around the age of 19 he already had his master's in biological sciences, and around that time he got smicha. In the end he had yodin, and he was trying to figure out what he wanted to be. Should he become a doctor, or should he become a Rosh Yeshiva? I won't keep you in suspense. He became a doctor, but every other time that I would speak with David, he would say, you know, I'd really rather be saying a shiur. So when guys would come from any yeshiva, but I know it from from yeshiva to miftar, when guys would come to David emergency clinics, which we'll get to in a moment, when they would come, David would, after he attended to them, he would ask them what yeshiva they learned in, and no matter what yeshiva, he'd ask them what sefer they were learning, and then he would ask them to say a Dvar Torah on the Gemara that they were learning. Sometimes he told me that there's this guy who came with he needed stitches. He knew a certain Tosos. David came, when he came to Israel, he had done his internship in, if I remember correctly, in cardiology. But he got into emergency medicine. And he was first hired, he came to Israel in 1980, I think. And he was first hired by Magen David Adom. And he changed Magen David Adom. You know, he changed it because he realized that the way the stations were placed around Yerushalayim, people were dying because the ambulances didn't get to them fast enough. There was only one place the ambulances went out from. He did a scientific study, and which led eventually, if you ever walk past the railroad tracks, you'll see, for example, a small ambulance, and there's an ambulance in the parking lot here also. All of that is David's work, because it was all in one place in Romema, a place called Magen David Adom, which had the one emergency clinic in Yerushalayim, other than the emergency clinics in the hospital, which did not treat you necessarily for what you went to the hospital for. You had to know that on this Tuesday night, you had to go to Hadassah on Har HaTzofim if you had a orthopedic problem. Of course, that wouldn't be on Wednesday night. So you had to know in the newspapers, you had to find a newspaper when you broke a bone. Which hospital do I go to? And even then, you would wait endless amounts of time. If you think you wait long now, then it was something. Endless amounts of time. David decided to change all this. And the first thing he did was to take on the Magen David Adom emergency clinic, which was on Rehov Mem Gimel, where the major place was. That place was one step away from the morgue. It was awful, really awful. But it was a very cushy place. And David knew inside out why it was cushy. So he decided he's going to start his own emergency clinics. And of course, right away, he was sued by everybody with special interests. He enjoyed it because he knew he was changing the face of medicine. And in the end, of course, he won. Terem Clinics set a new standard for emergency care throughout Israel. David became a specialist in emergency medicine. In his short life, he published 50 papers also on various aspects of emergency medicine. Let me give you a sense just to read from this memorial volume of people wrote in. Not necessarily people who really, really knew him. A woman I don't know from Los Angeles, Bela Gruber, who known, our relationship with David began at Mai L'Chaim when I was a Kala. Rabbi Wernick said that we had to have two witnesses for breaking the plate. He called the yeshiva, and 30 minutes later, who walked in but David and Moshe Chaim Dambi. Moshe Chaim Dambi was a friend of David, who David later saved his life. I was 19 and so was David. And so began our friendship. David wrote out Tuba. I told you he became a sofer. Ours was the first he had ever made. Subsequently, we moved to L.A., the Dombies moved to Eretz Yisrael, and so too David. David got married, and to our regret, the Kesher wasn't as strong as because of the distance. But whenever I would happen to see David at weddings or bar mitzvahs in America, I felt like I'd just seen him the day before. "Hi, Bela," he would always say with a big smile. And we just picked up where we left off. But never in my life was I happier and more astonished to see David than when I woke up in Florida, in the hospital next to Micha during the time of his liver transplant. It was about 9:00 in the morning. And I saw a man with a beard standing by the door of our room. I said to myself, okay, it's probably the respiratory therapist again to do Micha's therapy. Then I bolted up in bed and said, "David, is that you?" He smiled. David had a terrific smile. And said, "Hi, Bela." He flew after fasting 24 hours on Tisha B'Av to come to Florida just to see how Micha was doing. "No big deal," he said. That was David. Then he said, "I'll be right back." And he went out, giving me time to collect myself. You cannot imagine how I felt. I'd been alone in Florida the whole time, with no family or friends, scared and lonely. Micha had a temperature of 102 degrees Fahrenheit on Tisha B'Av, and I was so frightened. Then in came David and took over. David had this incredible way of taking over. And nobody that I ever saw resented it. He just He was an emergency doctor. He wasn't fazed by anything. David was a cowboy. He looked for. He lived with action. I never saw him afraid of anything. There's this famous picture of David operating on an emergency procedure on a victim of a terror attack on King George Street while bullets were flying. I mean, that was David. Then in came David and took over. All the hospital staff flocked around him. David made sure that Michal was being well taken care of. And from the time David came, Michal was treated like royalty. Dr. Tsakis, the chief transplant surgeon, came in and greeted David like a brother. This is an article from Hamodia by a journalist. Some of you may have heard of him, Joel Rabibo, just reading part of it. He tells about that about 35 years ago, he had first met David when he was medical director of Magen David Adom, intensive care mobile unit. He started the intensive care mobile unit. I was a young reporter, hungry for scoops. My editor sent me to do a day in the life story at Magen David Adom and assured me that I'd find someone who's idealistic or miserable enough to provide me with inside stories. David was an idealist. He couldn't stand it when incompetence led to patients dying and was outraged that people had to wait so long in the ER to get care. At the time of our initial interview, he was excited about a treatment he was using to save heart attack patients, an injection of streptokinase that, if administered quickly, could prevent permanent damage to the heart. He was the first to try it in Israel. It was later introduced as standard emergency care treatment in ambulances. David wasn't a ranter and raver. He was a doer. He believed that the emergency medical system in Israel was inefficient and unresponsive to the needs of patients, and he could tell you how much time an average patient was spending in the emergency room and how much it was costing the system. He was convinced that putting the patient first would improve the quality of care and profitability, and that he could take the same per treatment payment paid by the health funds and make a profit. But David wasn't interested in wasting time fighting windmills. When he saw that he couldn't change the system from within, he set up Terem. Unlike most of us immigrants from America, considered an accomplishment to just survive the system, David changed it. Even if he had to go to court to fight those who tried to block him, as he did to get Terem off the ground. Going on, Harav Yisrael Meir Lau, the former Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel, spoke at David's funeral. I met him the first time not as a doctor and not as the head of a department, but as someone who came to me with his Rebbe, Hagon Harav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal, Rav Lau said. I saw how David Applebaum served his Rebbe with humility, like the smallest of students pushing his wheelchair. Then I did not know what a big doctor he was. When I came to visit Shari Tzedek after the terror attack on the number 2 bus, you know, there was a time in Israel when you used to list the bombings on the bus. Oh, the number 2 bus, the number 18, the number 4. There were buses that people were simply afraid to. When I came to visit Shari Tzedek after the terror attack on the number 2 bus, I'll never forget the light that shone on the face of the wounded when they saw him. He was for them a redeeming angel, because in addition to being a great doctor, he was a great man. With his beard and his payas tucked behind his ears, David grew those payas when he was 12. David was Mekadesh Shem Shamayim every day. He knew how to talk to people. he spoke. I'm sorry, this is also true. He spoke so calmly, so rationally. He was brilliant, but not intimidatingly so. He was confident and self-assured, but never boastful or arrogant. He had none of the ego issues that sometimes afflict those in the medical profession. Indeed, he was proud to tell me that all doctors at Terem punched a clock, including himself. Quote, people should get paid for the hours they work, he said, stating what was obvious to him, but not so obvious to others. I can't tell you the number of people that David would go to their homes to treat them. That's unheard of. That's only for an emergency medical doctor. I remember, bring to mind, my daughter was in Shari Tzedek. She had a very painful orthopedic operation. And I was leaving late at night. I think it was after midnight. And I'm waiting for the elevator. And David gets out of the elevator. He wasn't the Shari Tzedek doctor then. He wasn't working in Shari Tzedek. He was in Terem. Only in Terem. So I said, why are you here? He said, I come to see your daughter. 12 o'clock at night. David had a tremendous, terrific family, wife and six children. David gave me advice about sending kids to school, okay? About schools in Israel in general. He said a lot of people, when they send their children to school, they think, okay, I'm done. You know, the school is taking care of them. The school is going to raise them. And he used this very, 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 very sharp expression. He says, people are mafkir their children to schools. He said, I never thought I should do that. I'm their parent. Okay? They're not hefker. For that reason, of course, David was a problem for some schools. But always in good... don't be mafkir your children. When his two sons learned in Kerem Biavna, in Hesder, every week David would drive one afternoon to spend a full Seder learning with them in Kerem Biavna. Now we come close to I'll bring it to the last week. David's daughter, Nava, whom David used to refer to, I remember the first time he told me, he said, Nava's my tzedekes. She's a kid. We were at her bat mitzvah. She was getting married. How old was she, 20? She was in Shevut Lumi. She worked in Zichron Menachem, which is dealing with children with cancer, little kids with cancer. Not an easy sight. So there was a custom that David instituted in his family that whenever there was a simcha, a marriage, a bar mitzvah, he would publish a book of Torah, Chidushei Torah. He would write, his children would write, any relative, he published them, you know. So they wanted to put out a book because Nava was getting married. And he was so busy, he hadn't yet had time to write his Chidush. So he called me up three or four days before the wedding. And he said, do you know anything about a topic that was so recondite that I never even heard of the topic? Do you need Eidus Shatoyachal HaZimah and Eidus Bishtar? Never heard anything about that. Many years later, I came across somebody who talked about it, and I remember saying to myself, ah. But I said, no. So he said, oh, he's, you know, he doesn't know what he's going to do. He needs to write this, and he doesn't have time. I said, yeah, because you're making a wedding. He said, well, you also, I'm going to New York. I said, what? You've got a wedding in a few days and you're going to New York? What are you going to wedding for? What are you going to New York for? He said, I'm going to speak at Goldman Sachs. Now everybody lights up Goldman Sachs, right? You know, okay. I said, what? You know, what is Goldman Sachs, speaking at Goldman Sachs? I mean, I never heard David give investment advice. No, it was New York had suffered the 9/11, and David was considered a world-class expert on emergency medicine in urban disasters. So he was invited to address Goldman Sachs. Okay? So I said, how are you going to do that? He said, I'm leaving as soon as I'm done speaking. Okay? I said, David, you know, you're not going to Goldman Sachs right before Nava's wedding just to give this speech. Obviously, by this time, David was the head of the, in addition to having Teren, was the head of the emergency room at Shari Tzedek, which they were trying to build. And that takes big money. So if you want big money, where might you wind up? At Goldman Sachs, right? So I said, yeah, David, but you give this speech. You give the speech, but who's going to collect the money if you leave? And these were David's last words. He said, David, others will come after me. Others will come after me. I don't know who the others are. I want to tell you a story that David told me, and David was there with the person I'm going to tell you the story about. Tomorrow, I'll put this a little background. Tomorrow, you'll go to Har Herzl. If you go to the section in Har Herzl where the Chalalei Milchemet Shalom HaGalil are buried, you might see a gentleman with a long white beard, seeming as if he's tending a certain grave. And you'll come closer to that grave, and you'll see on the grave, says the name, Shlomo Alman. Shlomo Alman was a graduate of Shalavim. He also learned in the Mir. He was a lawyer. And he was killed in Mechamet Shalom HaGalil. So I was with a few guys from the yeshiva. It wasn't this yeshiva. And I said, I'm going to ask this man a question. I said, are you related to Shlomo Alman? He said, yes, I'm his father. Now, some of you might know that Robert Alman, his father, is a Nobel Prize winning physicist. He lives in this neighborhood. He won the Nobel Prize in economics. I said, tell me, is this story that I heard from David Applebaum about Rav Gustman? So he said, it's true. But I didn't have to go any further than that. It's true. This is when David came to Israel. So there was a great Rosh Hashiva in Israel. He'd been in America and also a survivor of the Vilna Ghetto. So the partisan during the war. His name was Rav Yisrael Gustman. Great, great Talmud Chacham. And I don't use the words lightly. And David became close to him. and he would take him places and take care of him at times. When Shlomo Alman was killed, Rav Gusman asked David to go with him to pay a shiva call on the Alman family. And when he came and sat down and started talking to them, he said the following thing. I'm repeating the story that I heard from David that Robert Alman said is true. He said, "We've both lost children. We share that in common. We've both lost a son. The difference between you, Dr. Alman, and me is this. In the Vilna ghetto, at night, the Nazis came and pulled my son out of bed and took him away. And it was so sudden and violent that he didn't even have a chance to put his shoes on. And I knew what that meant. I knew I would never see my son again. He was gone. And there was hunger in the Vilna ghetto. And there was starvation. And so Rav Gusman at the age of 18 or 19 was appointed by Rav Chaim Ozer, another name you should know, the Rav of Vilna, was appointed as a dayan in the Vilna Beis Din. Rav Gusman had no interest in anybody showing him honor or kavod, and he would lightheartedly tell people, "What does it mean? When I came into the Beis Din for the first time as a dayan, the Vilna Beis Din, as a dayan, Rav Chaim Ozer, the Rav of Vilna, stood up for me. And so all the other dayanim stood up for me." When something like that happens when you're 18, kavod doesn't mean anything to you afterwards. Rav Gusman said, "I took my son's shoes and sold them in the marketplace, as I remember, for 2 carats. 2 carats. 1 carat I gave to Rav Chaim Ozer's widow, and the other carat I ate myself. I fulfilled the curse of the Torah that you shall eat the flesh of your children. And that's how my son went away. And your son came to Shamayim, welcomed as a hero of Am Yisrael by the administering angels." When David was killed, I thought to myself, how in Shammai he would be. I mean, I was paralyzed for a while, but my head was working. How in Shammai would David be received? Abraham Lincoln said, "The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here." Yes, the world forgets and forgets immediately. But today, we are standing on the eve of an ultimate Yizkor. And you can't ask God to remember if you don't remember. You can't ask God for mercy if you don't give mercy for others. You can't ask God for tzedakah if you don't give tzedakah. So at least we will not, we refuse to forget. We carry on memory in a world of forgetting and ignorance in which the lie dominates. As I said this morning, it is not enough to say that God bind the departed to himself. See, we live in a world in which 1.5 million, 1.5 million, the numbers are just staggering. Children were killed by the Nazis. We live in a world in which Nava Applebaum, in which David Applebaum, how many lives could they have touched and saved? They're gone. The world is decimated. The world is bereft. There's an attack on goodness, there's an attack on justice. I want to tell you something about buses. At one time, buses in Israel were, you got on a bus and there was noise. Everybody was talking. Right? Of course, there were always the people in Israel who were talking to themselves. But you'd sit down, it was no big deal. You'd sit down and somebody would start talking to you. What else would you do on a bus? They didn't permit, I'm talking about a time when they no longer permitted cigarettes, nor did they any longer permit chewing garinim and spitting the seeds all over the bus, which I remember well. All those had been forbidden. So all you had to do was to talk to people, right? So you could get into interesting conversation. I get on the bus now, and nobody, it's silent, right? People are taking selfies of themselves. They're talking, I don't know, I assume they're talking to somebody, right? But they're not talking to each other. And of course, being Israel, the talking was in many, many languages. Then you got on buses at a certain time and you looked at the other people getting on the buses. Why? Because you didn't know which person was going to be carrying a bomb. And you wanted that. Why is that person wearing a jacket? It's not that cold. And that person looks like... So I guess it's our ignoring of everybody now on buses is a sign that we feel safer. So I have this relationship to buses that is odd. I have a particular relationship to the 18 bus. I don't really like the 18 bus. It's maybe neurotic, maybe almost psychotic. I get nervous on the 18 bus. This is the bus that Matt Eisenfeld got on. This is the bus that goes on the Ein Rifa'im where there was an explosion. What was the Cafe Hillel still there? You guys don't know? Well, you probably think it isn't there. So it's a very difficult bus ride for me. One more note. In the first Gulf War, when Saddam was lobbing scuds at Israel, and in order not to harm the sanctity of the coalition fighting Saddam Hussein, so Israel didn't respond on its own. So they gave us instructions for safety. You had to go into a sealed room. But there were no sealed rooms, right? So you got instruction how you sealed your room. You got sheets of plastic, and you hung the plastic, and you had gas masks, right? And when the alarm went off, now there's nothing that, without being in war, that's more scarier than this for the civilian population than a siren, a real siren, You had 90 seconds from the time they identified the trajectory of the Scuds going from Iraq to get to safety. So you get, right? Which means you have to get everybody into the sealed room, pull the plastic sheets down. We heard on a radio, I was for 30 days, I was actually in the Army. But we heard on the radio, when I was home with the kids, we heard on the radio that you should take a wet towel and put it in the door, but not wet. Pour some kind of chemical on it. That's actually, what?
Baking soda.
Baking soda, no, it was a chemical that I found out later could have poisoned us all. You know, like it was crazy. Okay, that was crazy, the sealed rooms. So sirens are something that always bring up memory. So the following, the name of this, we need a name. They asked me for a name of this. So I said Bus 21. So bus 20, the 21 bus was a bus that ran to my house. From Chorev girls to my house. Right? And the siren on Yom HaZikaron would go off. This is Yom HaZikaron, 1992, 1 year after the Gulf War. Okay, the siren would go off at night. There would be a siren at 8 o'clock, okay? And everything would stop. The bus stopped in the middle. And this is what happened on the bus, and when I got home, I wrote the following. You know something about poetry? The muse is a mean mistress. Okay? She says, I came to you. Right? Right. Bus rides in Jerusalem are burlets, cacophonies, or polyglot pings, hymns heavy with Hebrew, whirlwinds whispering in 70 tongues. Eve of Remembrance Day, survivors of the flood, refugees from Babel, prove life in verbal volume. Babel is pierced by a siren's cry, how it sent us running last year, counting the seconds from its first blast. We had 90 to get sealed and masked. A discordant note in speech symphony. Tonight, the siren warns of an attack of memory. No plastic or tape, no mask or shelter for protection. Words grow weary. Bus, end talk, stop. Speakers of 70 languages rise, bow their heads, and memory explodes. A voice is no longer heard on buses, over telephones, in whispers of lovers before dawn, of mouths filled with earth. That Jews may talk tonight on the 21 bus on King David Street in Jerusalem. We speak with them again, yet once more, for a mute minute in sibilance of silence and labials of loss. The 71st tongue, the language of memory. Zohar, Zohar, Al Tishkach.
We're going to give everyone a picture and a name. On each name is a different soldier who was fallen in one of Israel's wars, and you're going to learn in a chavruta. And the first thing you do is find out about them. I'm going to send you in a second a link with the